In this week's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, I interview Bryce Roberts from Indie.VC. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 310. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob, and I've given Mike the week off this week, so I have a very special guest joining me on the show today. His name's Bryce Roberts from Indie.VC. If you haven't heard about Indie.VC, they're taking a really interesting approach to funding companies, and it's much more around this fund-strapping approach that I've talked about before. If you recall, fund-strapping, which Colin from Customer.io is the first person I ever heard use that term, the idea is to raise a single round of funding to get to profitability or to help you grow faster, but not to have this implicit Series A that you need to raise, as Bryce says during our interview. And to be honest, I've never been anti-funding. I've always been anti-people thinking the only way to grow a software business is through funding, and then to raise that funding and have it require you to sacrifice your lifestyle, to relocate somewhere, to need to commit to growing a $100 million company with 200 people on the payroll. I mean, just all the stuff that never made sense. I always wondered, why can't you just raise a couple hundred thousand dollars to get to that seven-figure revenue mark faster or get there more efficiently, and then just pay investors back like a normal business does. Like when you start a car wash or a restaurant or a dry cleaner and you borrow money, you're not looking for an IPO. And that's the approach that I've started to take with my angel investments. Last three, I think, have been into companies that are going to be, I believe will all be seven or eight figure SaaS companies. And they're not planning to raise a round from institutional investors ever. That's the premise, is they needed some cash to get to growth and to go beyond that. So Indie.VC is doing a similar thing. We talk in detail about their exact terms. And of course, they have their terms published on GitHub, which is super cool because you can look through the docs that I think you'd sign if you were to take money from them. But just a fascinating conversation here with Bryce, who's really going against the grain of traditional venture capital. And I think it's a good interview. I hope you enjoy it. So thanks so much for joining me today on the show, Bryce.
You bet. Super happy to be here.
As I said in the intro and folks just heard, you run Indie.VC. And I first heard about Indie.VC probably close to 2 years ago, and it was on Hacker News. There was a big discussion of, at the time you had like a long form letter at Indie.VC, that's your URL. And it was basically explaining this kind of new premise or a new investing ideology. And it was about not having to have this $100 million or $1 billion exit to make money, but that you wanted to fund businesses that could achieve profitability and didn't need to be a unicorn in order to be profitable for investors. And this was really groundbreaking. And at the time, I think it was anonymous. Is that right? The way you published it?
It was anonymous unless you clicked the one, you know, there were like two links on that original letter. One of them was to sign up for a Slack channel that we'd set up to answer questions. And if you clicked on that, you would see it would go to my inbox. So you would see that I was at OATV, but otherwise there was no messaging or branding or anything else like that on it. So yeah, that created a stir in that Hacker News thread as well.
What was your thought process behind doing that anonymously?
Thought process was that, just as we laid out in the original letter, that it was an experiment. And so if for any reason that this was a failure, we didn't get anyone interested in it, no one wanted to apply, that we could have it set up completely separate from OATV. And if it didn't work out, we'd just take the site down and we'd move on and go back to our day jobs. And so, you know, wanted a little bit of that abstraction, but also, you know, I think it's a little bit a part of our brand and, you know, kind of marketing anyway, which is not intentional. It just is like, it feels like you ought to have to do a little bit of work to get to know us and to get to know what we're trying to do. And so, you know, I think it creates a little bit of scarcity, a little bit of intrigue. And then as a result, it kind of drew people a little more closely in.
Mm-hmm. I remember feeling when I read the letter, because if I recall, it was in like Courier font and stuff. It gave me like the hacker ethos, you know, it made me feel like the DIY ethic of like, this is really cool. This is like grassroots. And it was a neat feeling. For folks, you mentioned OATV a couple times. For folks who aren't familiar with that, could you let them know what that is?
To be clear, the DIY is really important to us. That kind of, you know, really raw, bare bones. So, you know, everything you saw in that first iteration and, you know, most of what you see now is still like, that's just me writing, posting. So that's something that's important to us and always has been. In terms of OATV, OATV is a venture fund that I helped co-found back in 2005 with two partners. One is my partner, Mark Jacobson, and the other is someone who's pretty well known in technology, my partner, Tim O'Reilly. So OATV stands for O'Reilly Alpha Tech Ventures. It was a seed fund that Tim and I and Mark started in 2005 when seed investing really didn't have a name. It wasn't necessarily a category yet, but you know, we were probably one of the first, I would say handful, maybe five, kind of institutionalized seed funds that got going back then.
Very cool. Could you talk people through the premise? I guess you had the experiment that went out a couple years ago in terms of the letter and kind of vetting people. I know you started with a cohort approach, and I think you're no longer doing that. I think you had a fixed amount you invested up front, and now you're more flexible based on the business. Could you maybe tell people about where you're at today, just so they have an idea of what is Indie.VC? Like, how is it different than just a traditional venture fund in terms of from the entrepreneur's perspective?
So, I mean, the history is 2005, we set up a seed fund to, you know, really kind of introduce a new kind of optionality for entrepreneurs, not necessarily just bridge between seed and VC, but actually create some options for folks looking to kind of run cash efficiently. And as you can appreciate, part of the whole premise and the whole opportunity around seed was that the cost for getting these businesses online up and going was just dropping significantly. So whether it was open source software, hosted infrastructure, you name it, all of those things were starting to drive cost out and making it more accessible to entrepreneurs, which is kind of conventional wisdom right now. But back then, this was some wild, wild thinking. And so part of what IndieVC was a response to was, you know, 10 years into running OATV, it had become clear that some of those options that we had hoped seed investing would introduce to folks had kind of fallen by the wayside. Those options, as we saw them, were you could, you know, take a small amount of seed funding and then go raise from traditional VCs. That was one option. But the other two we thought were just as important for founders. And those were, you know, you could raise a little bit of money, make a tremendous amount of progress, and without having to raise more money, without having to take on more of that dilution and oversight from VCs, you could sell relatively early for a smaller acquisition, say, you know, sub $100 million type of acquisition, and it would still be a meaningful return, likely a life-changing outcome for the founder, but a meaningful return to a small fund, which is what we got started with. And then the third was, given how little capital these types of businesses take to get going, and given how strong and just wide those margins are, the profit potential for profit margins are, given how efficient these things are, there ought to be a path where you just raise a little bit of money and then you just run that business as long as you want to based on your profits and revenue. So 10 years in to OATV and this whole seed investing experiment, we were looking back and just saying, okay, part of that promise we've delivered on, you know, and that was kind of filling the gap between seed, you know, kind of angel investors and VCs. But those two other options seem to have fallen by the wayside as fundraising kind of has become the business model for so many of these companies that are getting started right now. You know, when we started, a seed round was $250K, $500,000. A seed round now can be up to $5 million. You know, whether you include their pre-seed or their post-seed or their A2 or whatever these things are, right? Fundraising was intended to kind of be a pain reliever, but, you know, the way we've looked at it is that, you know, it's now become this gateway drug to this larger kind of unicorn culture that's been built up around startups. And so IndieVC was, you know, in some ways is a response to that, to try to capture some of that optionality again. And I think part of your question was how we get our returns. And as you can appreciate, you know, we are still a venture fund. You know, we raise a pool of capital, we put that to work, our investors expect a return on that investment. And I think the one dimension that was pretty unique to IndieVC style investing is that not only can we kind of make a return in the event that a company goes public or gets bought, you know, in an acquisition, we can also make a return if founder decides they want to run that business indefinitely and profitably. We can take our return out in something that we call, you know, distribution. So if a founder wants to keep running that business, wants to be paying themselves, really reaping the benefits of running a large, profitable, growing business, we just take our return out in cash as that business continues to grow. And that's as kind of plain vanilla as that sounds, that was at the time and continues to be a fairly radical concept, given that the venture funded model suggests that any dollar you take in, you're reinvesting in growth. And so the idea that founders would be taking money out to put into their own pockets seems to run counter to, you know, so much of what's already happening, you know, in that kind of venture funded world.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what I liked initially about the Indie.VC model and what you're still doing today. And in a second, I'll run through your terms, which are published on GitHub. You have the exact terms that you give everyone. But I was having a number of conversations right as I started just doing a couple angel investments a few years back. And my interest has never been in the unicorns. I would much rather have a smaller business that has a much, much higher chance of success. Typically, it's going to be B2B SaaS, because that's what I know. And I wanted to be able to put a small amount of money to work, and, you know, small amount, 5, 10, 20, 25 grand, whatever, kind of get some money in and not have to swing for the fences and not have to swing for an acquisition. And I kept looking for models to do this. And the only one that I stumbled upon was, it was the way that like car washes and brick and mortars are funded. And that's partially, and then when I saw that you guys were doing this, it just, my head exploded of like, yes, someone is trying to apply this to startups and software companies that we know, if they're smaller, they can just throw off a ton of cash, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, this is, despite the kind of original letter that was posted, it was actually posted January 1, 2015. That's when that kind of IndieVC site went live. But the buildup to that was really probably 5 or 6 years of conversations. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine who'd invested in a couple of restaurants. And I was kind of wrestling with a lot of these ideas and asked how they structured that, you know, given a local restaurant isn't likely to IPO and it's not likely to be their ambition to IPO or even get bought. You know, I was asking how they structured their return. And in having that conversation and a bunch subsequently with other types of businesses, I thought, man, you know, a restaurant business, the margins in a restaurant business are just so paper thin in general. Like, why couldn't we be trying this with tech businesses where your margins are oftentimes 60, 70, 80, I've even seen 90, 95% in the investments that we've been looking at. That feels like a real opportunity to pursue that model for returns. And yet, you know, it just runs so counter to the business model of VC investing at this time that very, very few people would really consider executing that, at least at a fund level. Like you said, you know, there are some people who are trying to find those for angel investments, but from a kind of a fund level, it hasn't been necessarily as attractive or as accepted just because the model hasn't been proven out just yet.
Right. And there, you know, we hit a point, as listeners know, my startup Drip was acquired a few months ago by Lead Pages. And we had hit a point a few months before that where we were really having internal conversations about the possibility of raising a small round because our growth was being hampered or dampened by the lack of cash. It was the first business I'd ever run where that was the case. All the other ones, I always had ample cash to grow them because they were smaller businesses. But we were really talking about that. And there was no chance I was going to go down the traditional VC route. It just was not. I never saw Drip, even though it had the market potential to be large. It wasn't in my interest to, you know, to be the CEO of some.
Why is that? Why didn't you think the venture path was the path for you?
Because I honestly value my lifestyle a little too much. I didn't want to have to relocate. I didn't want, you know, I have my wife and kids, and we have a pretty good life. I didn't want to feel the constant pressure of, you know, get to 100 million, you should be hiring more, hire, hire, hire. My friends who've raised VC, that seems to be, you know, the thing is you need to get headcount up. And the idea of running even a 30, well, 30 was reasonable. But when I started thinking about a 50-person team, it was just not, it wasn't appealing. And I think that feel like, I know you don't necessarily lose control with your first round, but I looked down the line and thought, boy, you raise a Series A and then a B. And if that's the path, then eventually, are you still running your company, or have you pushed all the chips into the table, the center of the table, and said, I need to get to 100 million or I go bust?
Well, it's interesting because that's actually a conversation I had recently with a good friend of mine who we kind of spun up our seed funds at roughly the same time. And we were talking about this model, and he was expressing frustration around what he termed the implicit A, right? Even at a seed round, like you said, you want to believe that first round of funding really isn't going to alter your course all that much. But the reality is there's an implicit A as soon as you take that seed round these days. And most of the advice and most of the effort and most of the incentives around that seed round of funding end up pushing you towards another round of funding and another round of funding. And so as harmless as it may feel like it is, you know, it's really become, like I said, this implicit A at the tail end of any round of funding. And that's something, you know, that's something we kind of wanted to be a counter to, right? We wanted to hopefully present a different set of options for a founder. And it's something we're seeing now. I mean, that same kind of situation you found yourself in at Drip, we're finding there's a large number of companies who have grown. They could really unlock a lot of value in their business with an extra, you know, 250K or 500K or whatever it is. You know, there's like a couple of hires they can't make out of cash flow, or there is a new line of business they can't fund out of cash flow, or there's a new product that's additive to what they're already doing that they want, that they can't fund out of cash flow. And it's within that group of founders, we really found a lot of resonance. And for us, a lot of potential investment opportunities. And I think what we can offer to them is, it's funny, we just had one of our quarterly retreats in Chicago this last weekend. And one of the founders who's a part of the NDVC, you know, group of companies said something along the lines of like, this is just enough VC BS, right? It's like, we haven't bought all of it, but it's like, there's still a level of accountability. You still have a partner in the business that isn't with you day to day. There's still kind of a much broader network for folks who maybe aren't in the Bay Area that we can provide to them, that they can access. And so that's really kind of what we're trying to provide, is just enough of that kind of VC oversight without necessarily the kind of levers that so many VCs have, which are, you know, voting rights. And, you know, they become shareholders, but they become shareholders of a preferred class of stock. There's a lot of layers of control that you give up, and also optionality that you take off the table when you go that route. And hopefully what we've tried to do in structuring the terms of NDVC is really address those in a kind of a hard-coded way, where, you know, everybody's playing all their cards face up, so that, you know, we can offer to an entrepreneur a certain level of service and a certain level of capital, and they can kind of play their cards up in terms of what it is they're trying to build. Because as your audience may appreciate, when you go out to pitch that round of funding to investors, even, you know, you'd mentioned you really value your lifestyle. You mentioned that you may not be the right CEO to be running a 50-plus person team. If you walk into an office of an investor and make that presentation, you can't honestly tell them that. Right, you have to tell them about how this is going to become a multi-million, you know, multi-hundreds of millions of dollar business. And we think that's a real opportunity for us. And we think that, you know, the more founders are kind of empowered to build the business they're best suited to build, and that we can support in doing that, we think that those returns for us will still be every bit as compelling as the returns we'd be seeing in the traditional seed investments that we've been making.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's the key, is something you just touched on, which is there are a lot of businesses that are really great businesses that I think raise funding and get run into the ground because they would be great 5, 10, 15, 20 million dollar ARR businesses, highly profitable, and they go for the, you know, the $100 million thing, and then they implode because they just can't get there for whatever reason. So,
there was a fascinating post written, I think it was last week, by a VC saying, here's how you kind of end up in a bad position with your board. And the scenario he gave was a founder who'd raised, you know, two or three rounds of funding. Their business was doing about $5 million a month. And now the founder couldn't raise any more money. The founder couldn't sell the business. And now, you know, they're kind of locked horns with their VCs. And, you know, I think most people who aren't kind of in that unicorn echo chamber would say, wow, if I had the opportunity to run a $5 million a month software business, like, sign me up for that, right? But, you know, it's that type of misalignment with the kinds of companies some founders are best suited to build, and the things that oftentimes, I think the other disconnect too is just timelines, right? I mean, there may be a timeline in which that entrepreneur, you know, if given that opportunity, could grow from $5 million a month and become that massive kind of outcome, but not on the timeline that a VC really needs it to happen in, which is typically 5 years. And so they would much rather see that founder kind of crash and burn and sell that business for parts, because for every, you know, month or quarter that goes by that they have to sit on that board, board and that business is kind of consuming its time, it's time that's taken away from the potential unicorns that are already in their portfolio, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. So I want to switch it up just a little bit here and dig deeper into the specifics of how you guys work. So I'm on GitHub right now, and I'm going to link, you know, your website, and you have a Medium post, and you have the GitHub repo where you have all your docs. And my understanding is that you invest between $100,000 and $500,000 into each startup, and you essentially don't actually take equity in the business up front, and it's only upon an acquisition that that would happen. And then the repayment, and this is how, where you're based more on cash flow than on exit or liquidity event, the repayment is 80% of distributions until you're paid back 2x your investment. And then it flips to, what does it flip to after that? Is it flip 20-80?
So it's, yeah, 20-80. That's
okay,
right.
Okay, perfect. So that's 80-20 to your fund until you get 2x back. Then it goes 20-80 to your fund versus the founders. And that's up until 5x your investment. And then it stops. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so the idea is if someone, you know, there's a bunch of Hacker News threads if folks search it, but there's a conversation where you actually address specifically, someone says, you know, what if a founder comes on and then they just raise their salary, you know, up to $1 billion or whatever, instead of taking out dividends, because it's when the dividends are distributed. That's when the 80-20 stuff kicks in. You have clauses that help with that, right? They can only raise their salary up to a certain amount or by a certain percentage based on, you know, from when you guys invest.
That's right. There's a bunch of different models that people have tried out around how to trigger these types of distributions. Several of those have been, they'll tie it to profitability, they'll tie it to revenue. There's a whole industry that's forming now around revenue-based financing where, you know, they immediately start to take a percentage of the revenue that comes in every month, and they get paid back up to a certain return as well. What we tried to do was tie it to incentives, right? And so, as you mentioned, when we make an investment, we aren't a shareholder in your business. It's structured essentially as a loan with no maturity date. And so there isn't an interest accruing and there isn't a date at which that note will be called back. The kind of unique element to the one we've structured, as you touch on, it's our repayment is really tied to the incentives of the founder, right? And so if the founder wants to start taking a significant amount of cash out of the business, we share in that. So we tie it to total compensation. So if a founder's total comp, let's say it's $100,000 when we make the investment, we allow them to continue, we want them to continue to grow and to pay themselves and be able to reap the rewards of growing their business. So we say up to 150% of that initial kind of baseline that we set, that's yours. Once you start to pay yourself above and beyond that, that's what we consider a distribution. And so that's when the splitting, you know, the 80-20 and then the flipping to 20-80 occurs, is once they've kind of decided that, you know, maybe they do want more of a cash flow lifestyle business. We are fully in line or aligned with them around them being able to grow and run that kind of business. We just want to be able to share as that cash flow starts coming out of the business. And in the case where we do become a shareholder, there's really only two scenarios where that happens. One, the founder decides to raise a more traditional round of VC funding. And so if someone, you know, is running the business profitably for years, but they decide to end up going and raising an additional, you know, bringing on VCs to really scale up because they now see, you know, kind of their outsized opportunity, we just convert in as part of that round at a pre-agreed upon percentage of whatever that is. And then if they sell anywhere in there, we convert into common shares and go through as part of that acquisition.
Very cool. And there's a comment on Hacker News from someone who is obviously an Indie.VC portfolio company. And he says, there's a whole discussion of it, but he says, this is why I enjoyed being part of Indie.VC. Zero emphasis on pitching or raising the next round. No demo day. All the focus was on growing a real business.
No, it's like I said, we just did a meetup in Chicago this last week. What we're doing now is we did kind of our first cohort last year where we invested $100,000 into 8 companies. And each quarter we would get together with those 8 companies and not work on their pitches, but actually work on their business. So we would bring in subject matter experts for, you know, things that they were wanting to kind of build expertise around. And at the end of that year, we said, look, we can continue to do this or not. And it was kind of unanimous within the group that they'd like to continue to have these meetups. So this was our first opportunity to start folding in new members, you know, new investments that we've been making, you know, since the beginning of the year. And the response from a lot of the new folks was really positive. They were really taken back by what it meant to just focus on revenue and growth and profitability. One comment I remember from the weekend was someone led off their answer to a question by saying, back when I used to think raising money was cool, I did X, right? And so there's this, at its kind of most basic, part of what we wanted to really see is this idea that you become who you hang around, right? And so if you have a group of companies now who all are focused on fundraising and you plug into that group, guess what you're going to start focusing on, right? You're going to start focusing on fundraising. You're going to start solving your problems with going and raising another round. What we're seeing now within the group, and knock on wood, a year and a half in, all of those eight companies are all still in business. Some of those have gone from kind of standing starts to profitable. We're seeing that there's real value in having a group of like-minded founders who want to build their companies in the same way that you're trying to build yours for that support in that network. And so, you know, we think that's a pretty, it seems subtle, but as the Hacker News commenter mentioned, it's actually a pretty powerful undertone to create within a group. And you know, we've now done five of these, and I can count on one hand the number of times we've ever even talked about investor presentations or talking to VCs.
Right. Yeah, that's super cool. I mean, it does become an amazing site now when I go to, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in the East Bay. So the Silicon Valley culture is very much part of me growing up. But when I go back now, I haven't lived there for 20 years almost. And when I go back now, I'm just struck by, when I go to a conference or whatever, I'm struck by just the one track mind. Everyone is just talking about the pitching and talking about the raising and talking about raising money. And I keep thinking, why, like, people are focusing on building slide decks rather than building businesses. You know, that's kind of become my quote.
No, exactly. I mean, like I said, fundraising is the business model of this kind of new unicorn, you know, obsessed startup cohort. And so I think there's a real opportunity for us. We have some investments in the Bay Area, but I tried living in the Bay Area, and I now live in Salt Lake City, Utah. We aren't geographically focused. We don't just invest in the Bay Area. We don't make people move to the Bay Area to be a part of what it is we're doing. I think a line that really resonated in that original piece that I wrote at IndieVC was, you know, bloom where you're planted. So we try to embody that both in the support we provide for our companies. But like I mentioned, we did our last retreat in Chicago. We try to expose our company, you know, one, visit the companies in their local markets and support them there. So we have a couple of companies that are in Chicago, but also give exposure to people who aren't from Chicago to the way local founders, local startup community there works. So they can see that it's different from their home states, but it's also different from kind of how the Valley works as well.
Yep. And I mean, I like the idea from your perspective as someone running a fund that, you know, you then have diversification in across geographies, right? You're not, all of your eggs are not in the Bay Area basket and all not pulling from the same talent pool and all not getting in the same group thing. So I think there's an advantage to the kind of the diversity you have there.
No, it's been great. And it was fun because one of the folks who came to a dinner we hosted while we were in Chicago tweeted out after they'd left, you know, this is a person who'd done the VC funded startup thing. They, you know, pretty well-known name in the startup community. And, you know, they're just totally burnt out after their last kind of venture fueled startup experience. And they tweeted out after the dinner how energized they were, that it was so refreshing to be around these kinds of founders who were actually building real businesses and how that had reinvigorated them to be thinking and working towards their next company. I think there really is something to that. I think there's a group of people who really want to have an impact, who want to build something that doesn't necessarily rely on getting permission from an investor to be able to have it exist and have it to, you know, kind of impact people in the world in a meaningful way. So I love that person at the dinner picked up on the energy, and we hope that there's a lot more of that energy we can help unlock through IndieVC.
Sounds great. Well, thanks again, Bryce, for coming on the show. I really want to be mindful of your time today. If folks want to learn more about IndieVC, they can obviously go to www.indie.vc. If folks want to keep up with you, is, you know, maybe Twitter, what's the best place?
Yeah, IndieVC is the best place. It's kind of a jumping off point, and you'll also see a unicorn that's burning. And so you might enjoy seeing that. For me, I'm just, I'm at Bryce on Twitter. You can at reply me. We also have a Twitter account that's pretty active for IndieVC, at IndieVC, one word on Twitter. And then I'm not great at email, but if you want to email me, I will definitely see it. And if it's interesting, there's a high likelihood I will reply to it. And I'm just Bryce, Bryce, at oatv.com.
Sounds great. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you, Rob.
If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.